Welcome to Underdog to Unstoppable. I'm Nicole Anderson, and today we're proving that no matter the odds, resilience rewrites the story. You're watching Now Media Television. Welcome to Underdog to Unstoppable, the show where we explore the real journeys behind resilience, reinvention, and rising when the odds are stacked against you. I'm your host, Nicole Anderson, and each week we sit down with individuals who know what it means to be counted out and choose to keep going anyway. Today's guest is Todd Thomas, a recognized voice in artificial intelligence, energy, sustainability, and entrepreneurship. Todd is the best-selling author of Hyperscale and the Unleashing Abundant Energy Trilogy, and the founder and CEO of Woodchuck.ai, a climate impact startup transforming waste into value and helping shape a more abundant energy future. Todd has built a career at the intersection of emerging technology and execution, but his journey didn't begin with recognition or applause. Like many underdogs, his early path was marked by effort without visibility, capability without acknowledgement. Todd, welcome to Underdog to Unstoppable. We're honored to have you here. And today, we're starting with a place many people know all too well, showing up, doing the work, and still being overlooked. This is about what it takes to keep believing in yourself before the world gives you a reason not to.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here today.
Many capable people feel invisible despite their effort. They work hard, improve their skills, and stay disciplined, yet remain overlooked. This season of being unseen can quietly erode confidence, even as it strengthens resilience behind the scenes. Todd, I'm so happy to have you with us today. And it's very important that we get the backstory so that we understand how you built your companies and you authored your book and where you're going in your future. So tell us a little bit about your background.
So I have been an entrepreneur since very early on. I've really spent most of my career on startups, building new products, building new companies. I love the fluid kind of opportunistic environment of a startup. So it's a lot of fun. But obviously building a startup is really risky and difficult, and the vast majority fail early. So it's very difficult to build a startup, and it can be extremely rewarding. But a lot of times you'll spend tons of time, perhaps years, building something. And at some point you need to pivot and move on. So I think it certainly fits well within your structure of looking for that early resilience for, you know, that 30-year overnight success, right?
Yeah, that overnight, you know, everybody, it just happens overnight, right? Like nothing. It's all, we're that part of that 1% that just, it exploded. So tell me, Todd, what made you get into entrepreneurship? What led you down this path?
Well, I think there's this myth about stability working in corporate America. And I've been in corporate America. I've worked for some really big companies as well. But I think the myth there is that if you land this big corporate job, you're going to have a stable spot, a stable career. But what I've seen is when you're in a big corporation like that, you're a cog within a much larger machine. And a lot of times your efforts, either your successes or your failures, really don't necessarily have a lot of impact on your path through that company. More often than not, the success of you is really dependent on the success of the larger team or the division or your boss or your boss's boss, who you may not even know. I've been at some really big companies where we were doing amazing work and entire divisions were let go. And so I find that really disconcerting. I would much rather be in an environment where I am going to succeed or fail based on my own merits, on my own work. And that's why I think a lot of entrepreneurs like that. They want to know that if they put in the work, that they're going to be successful based on their own merits. So I think, like a lot of other entrepreneurs, that's the environment I feel more safe and more confident.
I would have to agree. I think I knew, like, maybe 3 or 4 years into my corporate working, I was like, this is not going to be for me. But I knew that I had to get some experience and some wisdom under my belt. But I think, do you believe that, like, entrepreneurship is just in people? Like, there are just some people that it's just, they're destined for that, so they feel it early on? Or do you think it's something that's developed over the corporate structure?
Yeah, honestly, it's probably a little bit of both, you know, the whole nature versus nurture, and it's usually a combination of both. But I do think there is a streak within a lot of entrepreneurs that they don't want to be told what to do. They want to go out and figure it out and work on their own. And there are other people that really like to arrive at work and be given a list of things to do, and they can go check those things off and then they're done for the day. So there are, you know, certainly two different types of people. And 100%. I think, yes, the entrepreneurs are much more likely to want to follow their own path.
And, you know, I think every workplace needs those people, right? Like to have a workplace, you do need people that, you know, they just want to come in, do their job and go home and get their paycheck and move on. Like you need them. And so were there moments like in the early years that you were like, you know, maybe it's not for me. Maybe I go back to corporate. Did you ever question like kind of your balance of what you wanted to do?
Certainly. I mean, I've gone back and forth. And I think when you spend a lot of time at a startup and you kind of go through that, you know, the stress of not knowing, hey, are we going to have enough money to cover payroll next week? Or, you know, what happens if we don't land this big client? Is that the end of the company? And you kind of live that roller coaster, right? And then you have the highs too. You land that big client, you sign a seven-figure deal and you're mm-hmm. floating high. So you live that roller coaster, and it's really emotional. So I think sometimes when a startup or an entrepreneurial venture kind of reaches its end, it's almost like, okay, well, I'm just gonna take a break and take a regular job and just get a paycheck for a while. And that almost feels like an emotional break, if you will. So I get the draw of that, but then, you know, before too long, you start to get that itch again to go do something on your own and do something new. And, you know, what if we could build this, it could really take off. And you just get that itch to go out and build something new.
Well, I think when I was working in those companies as I was building my career, I was always like, I could do this better, more effective, more efficient. And that wasn't always fair, right? An owner put their blood, sweat, and tears into something for me to say, well, I could do this more effective and efficient. So I would be like, okay, so it's just better for me to go off on my own because it's going to frustrate me because we're not doing things this way. And I think that was one of the things that was ultimately my driving force, right? Was I'm not going to disrespect their business because that's something that they've worked really hard for. What was kind of your consistency or your discipline to work your way up to being an entrepreneur? What did you have to do on a daily basis to make it happen?
So whether I was at startups or in the corporate world, that kind of the common thread throughout my career has always been leveraging emerging technologies, whatever that latest and greatest technology is. And you know, right now, and for several years now, it's been AI. And so kind of just like you're describing, a lot of times you're in a more traditional work environment and you realize that what you are doing could be done more efficiently. And maybe that drives you to create a new product or a new software or a new process. And you can go out and launch your own company and bring that solution to a broader market. And I think that's certainly the genesis of a lot of the things that I've done. It's like you notice a problem out there in the market. You realize if I could create a solution to this, this isn't just a solution for one client. This is a solution you could bring to the broader market and build a company on.
Okay. So if someone watching and they were like, okay, Todd, like what could I take away from you now in my early stages of building my AI company or any type of company in entrepreneurship? What could they take from you from your early years that you would do differently now?
So two things. And one is, you kind of already touched on this, but it's often good to start at a big corporation and let them train you for a couple of years and you know, take salary for a couple of years and get a little money in the bank. It also builds your resume, and I think you're more likely to get people that'll invest money in you if you've got a little bit of kind of big name companies on your resume that give you a little bit of credit. But then when you're ready to go out and try something on your own, I think it's really key that you start with the problem. I think a lot of startups build some type of solution, some type of technology that they're really excited about, and then they go out and try to find a client to buy that. And I think that's a really difficult way to go. I think startups that have a lot of success start the other way. You start with a problem. So whether it's at a company you're working at or just kind of a segment that you're familiar with, identify a problem and a problem that clients are willing to pay to solve. And then let that problem define the solution. Right now, AI is all the rage, but that doesn't mean that's the right solution for everything. Let the problem define the solution. Maybe it's a software solution, maybe it's a hardware solution, maybe it uses AI. But if the problem defines the solution, and then bring it to that client that has this problem that's willing to pay, and that really is kind of one of the first hurdles that a lot of startups never get over, which is that first paying customer.
Well, and I, you know, in my field, in my business, which is HR and recruiting, AI, which is very good for certain things, it's still not good for the legal aspect of what we do. And the courts don't recognize it. The American Bar Association has pretty much said you cannot use this to fill out your briefs because there are things in it that are incorrect. But I find myself all the time arguing, right? Like I'm arguing with people on... Well, ChatGPT told me this, and I'm like, okay, it's a great tool and a resource, and I absolutely love it. But in this situation, it's not a solution for what you're looking for. And I think that that's a big point, right? Like, it may not be the solution, but there's ways to use it to become a solution, right? Or to as a resource to make your business better. Would you agree?
Yeah, AI is fantastic at taking over repetitive tasks. So yeah, in the HR world, if you want to use AI to review a bunch of resumes and summarize them for you, so you know maybe the average person, it takes you an hour to review 10 resumes. But with AI, maybe you can review 100 resumes in the same amount of time. So I really like to view AI as a force multiplier. I know a lot of people view AI and they're scared that you're going to cut people's jobs, you're going to lose jobs over that. And I view it differently. I think if you've got a small team of 3 to 5 people and they can do a certain quantity of work, if you can really utilize AI tools well, it doesn't mean you're going to lose any of those 3 to 5 people. It means those 3 to 5 people are able to get a lot more work done faster and oftentimes higher quality work because AI is also really good at identifying errors and removing those errors. So I think if you really use AI and incorporate those tools in your businesses, it's a force multiplier and an error reducer.
I completely agree. Coming up, we'll talk about what happens when responsibility is heavy, the pressure is real, and there's no safety net beneath you.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more unstoppable stories and strategies for turning obstacles into opportunities.
And we're back. I'm Nicole Anderson, and you're watching Underdog to Unstoppable on Now Media Television. Let's keep pushing past limits together. Welcome back to Underdog to Unstoppable. Want more of what you're watching? Stay connected to Underdog to Unstoppable and every Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand, anytime you want. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. On the move, you can also catch the podcast version right from our website at nowmedia.tv. For business and news to lifestyle, culture, and beyond, Now Media TV is streaming around the clock, ready whenever you are. Welcome back to Underdog to Unstoppable. I'm Nicole Anderson, and we're continuing our conversation with Todd Thomas. In this segment, we're stepping into a reality many underdogs face, carrying enormous responsibility with no backup plan. For many leaders, there is no margin for error. Financial pressure, personal responsibility, and professional risk collide, creating an environment where every decision feels like it could cost everything. This kind of pressure forges grit, but it also tests resilience. Welcome back, Todd. Thank you for joining us for this conversation. So tell me, do you have any pressure at all?
Absolutely. I think that's a pressure that founders and entrepreneurs all share and can commiserate over. Absolutely.
And so when you first started, most of the time you'll hear entrepreneurs say, well, I had a lot of family pressure because I had a family, you know, making a taking a risk, or I had people who were backing me. So I had that kind of pressure. Do you want to talk a little bit about which dynamic of pressures you had when you decided to jump into the entrepreneurship world?
Well, it's always a combination of those, right? You've got your own personal financial situation that you need to take care of. And then when you launch a new company or a new startup, somebody's backing you. It's whether it's your own money or it's a relative's money, or you bring in an investor, and now you're responsible for them as well. I think that ramps up when you start to hire people, because now all of a sudden you have employees that are counting on you and their families are counting on you. And if your company fails and you don't meet payroll, well, all those employees that are working hard for you and putting their blood and sweat into this as well, well, they're out of a paycheck, and how do they pay their rent? So yeah, absolutely. I think all entrepreneurs and founders feel that stress, and it doesn't go away quickly. As you grow, more people rely on you, and the financial numbers keep getting bigger, and that stress can just feel to become heavier even as you start to have some success.
Have you, so during your journey, did you scale? Did you scale some of the companies that you founded? So tell us a little bit about that scaling process, and what led you, even with the financial pressures and the risk, what led you to decide, hey, I'm gonna scale. I'm gonna make this big. Like, I don't have a choice.
Well, I think the dream, anytime you start a new company, you start a startup or whatever it is, the dream is to scale, right? There's not a lot of people that go out and put a ton of effort and risk into launching a company, hoping that they just, you know, do fine for the rest of their life. That's not the dream, right? The dream as a unicorn, the dream is to go big. So you pick the idea, you pick the concept, and you start building your team with the concept that this is going to be hugely successful and you're going to grow and scale. So I think every entrepreneur, every founder, you know, that's the focus. That's in your mind. How do we build something that will work across the entire segment, across multiple segments? How do we build something that can really scale? How do we launch this thing?
And when you decided to scale and or go to other build other companies, how did that pressure teach you to lead?
Well, I think what you realize fairly quickly is anytime you launch a new venture, a new startup, a new company, you don't know what you don't know. There's lots of things beyond your control. There's lots of things beyond your vision. So you don't know necessarily the hurdles that are coming, but you can know that there is something coming, even if you don't know what it is. So I think as an early stage startup, as an early founder, you need to plan for ambiguity, recognize that you don't know what you don't know, and have some flexibility built into your processes and have some flexibility built into your product, and count on problems occurring. Like, you don't know what that problem is, right? There's some bug that you can't find, that you can't solve, or, you know, your equipment breaks down and you're non-operational for a week. You maybe don't know that that's going to happen, but you know that something's going to come. So build some margin of error in there. Build some type of safety net. So when that unexpected problem happens, maybe you didn't know the specific problem, but you knew that something's going to happen. Some type of hiccup always comes along. So be ready for that. So be ready for ambiguity. And be ready for that problem that you haven't identified yet.
Well, I know, like, early on in starting my company, I would lead by fear, right? When you go back and you talk about, you have people who are you're responsible for, and they have families that they're responsible for, and so I was leading a lot by fear, where it was like, and they could feel that they could. They got that from my energy, and it was, and so I had to learn, like, it took time, but I eventually learned to lead in confidence, right? To lead where, you know, we're going to make this happen. We're going to figure it out. Like, we're going to make it work. Cause most people knew you're in a startup, right? Like, they knew they came in early on. They know their employee 1, 2, 3, and 4. So it's not like they had it. There was any secrets. But did you ever feel that you led by fear in the beginning, where it was just like, oh my gosh, if I don't make this work, but then that was rubbing off on your staff?
Yeah, I think when people talk about the loneliness of leadership, the loneliness of a founder, I think that's where that comes in, because you do have a lot of fears, a lot of anxieties. But a lot of times that they're those are good things. Like those are things you need to worry about. Those are problems you need to solve. So fear in and of itself isn't a bad thing. But I think the loneliness is, you know, you as the founder, or you as the leader, you know, you wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning and you sit there and do math all morning until the sun comes up, right? Of how much money is coming in, how much money is going out, and how do I make this work? And, you know, what are the other issues that you're trying to solve? And that's kind of your personal loneliness and your personal fear. Because when you get to that 8 o'clock meeting with your team there, you need to be the one setting the vision and driving the confidence and getting everybody up. So it's totally fine to have those fears, and those fears can be healthy and can help you address problems and can help you be prepared. But at the same time, you need to be able to contain that. And when you're in front of your team, you need to be able to drive that vision and make them understand, you know, based on these things, these are our priorities for today. And maybe some of those priorities for the day are driven by the fears you were up thinking about all night long. Don't share that part with your team. Don't let them know you've been worried about it since midnight, but share with them, yes, these are the things we need to get done today. Here's the priorities and these are why. So you need to, as the leader, translate those fears into actionable tasks and share that vision with your team.
That's a phenomenal response. Like I think our viewers can take a lot from that, especially early startup entrepreneurs. Did you have a coach or a mentor, or did it take you a few years to get to that point where you were able to afford a coach and a mentor? Or, you know, the ego part of it, right? Like, I can do this. I don't need anybody. Did you have one to start with? Did you get a coach? Some of our viewers are probably tossing up that idea, especially from leading with fear, right? And trying to understand that that's not the direction that they need to go.
Well, I've been fortunate to work with a bunch of really smart people and people that support me. But there is no better teacher than experience. And certainly I have failed and I have made mistakes and have paid consequences for that. But again, that in and of itself isn't the worst thing. You make a mistake, you pay a consequence, and you learn from it. And hopefully you're less likely to make that same mistake again. I would say early on in, you know, some of the first startups that I worked in, you know, a tight financial situation, cash flow, that stressed me out. And so I wouldn't always give it the attention that it deserved. I would almost like, you know, I'm scared to look at that cash account, so I'm not going to open that today. Terrible mistake, right? You want to, whatever it is you're scared of, face it head on, right? Whatever that fear is, face it head on. And take that previous mistake and turn it into a strength.
Yeah, that's 100%. Like I think there was like 2 or 3 years in there where I was like, somebody would say, well, how much cash flow do you have? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't even want to look at it. I was like, the bills get paid. That's all I know. So I agree with that. It's like that anxiety of, well, there's probably not money in that account, so I'm just not going to look at it. It's just better that way. Todd, for the people who want to follow your work and learn more about you and what you're building, where can they connect with you? Where can they purchase your book? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So my current company is called Woodchuck AI, and you can find us on online. We're woodchuck.ai. So come and check it out. We're building something pretty cool there. If you're interested in the books, I've written multiple books, and so I'm on Amazon.com. You just go to Amazon and look me up. My most recent book is called Hyperscale. It's about AI data centers and the growth in global energy capacity. So you can check me out there, or you can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm just Todd Thomas at LinkedIn. So hopefully pretty easy to find.
Thank you, Todd. Up next, we'll explore the intricate details and the internal battles that many underdogs face. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more unstoppable stories and strategies for turning obstacles into opportunities.
And we're back. I'm Nicole Anderson, and you're watching Underdog to Unstoppable on Now Media Television. Let's keep pushing past limits together. Welcome back to Underdog to Unstoppable. External obstacles are real, but often the toughest battle is internal. In this segment, we're addressing the voice that quietly limits potential long before opportunity arrives. Many underdogs carry limiting beliefs rooted in past mistakes, criticism, or comparison. These narratives shape identity and behavior. Until they're challenged, transformation begins when the internal story changes. Todd, what was your limiting beliefs within yourself when you first started your entrepreneurship journey?
Well, I think we all have doubts and we all have fears. And as you're facing initial challenges and launching your business, I think it's very natural to think, oh, are these problems because I'm not smart enough? I don't have enough experience. I don't have enough money. I think those are all really natural fears. And if you're ultimately going to succeed, you need to face those fears and fight through them. So I think that's a struggle that every entrepreneur faces.
And did you have any naysayers like in the background? Did you have any people that were just like, this isn't going to work? Or what are you doing? Why would you leave a security of a paycheck? Did you have any of that?
Everybody does. Absolutely. I mean, anytime you tell your friends you're launching a startup, right? And some of them are like, wow, that's really brave. And some are like, oh, are you crazy? Is your wife going to leave you? What's going on?
Midlife crisis.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, even sometimes when people are trying to be supportive, kind of the way they phrase it, like, wow, that is really brave in this economy. You know, it's, mm-hmm. But if you believe in yourself and believe in your concept, you've got to fight through that. And that's absolutely a hurdle or a challenge that every entrepreneur is going to face.
Well, I think I use this story sometimes. Bless my mom, but she, when I started my business, I was probably a year in, and she was like, so when are you getting a real job? And I'm like, I've been on the pounding pavement 80 hours a week. What are you talking about? Like, I got a real job. Some people just don't understand, right? They don't understand what that looks like. Was there a moment when you realized that the voice in you was the one telling you that this wasn't going to happen versus other people telling you?
I think it's both. And I think it comes and goes. You know, when you have a string of successes, it's easy to fly high and feel really good about what you're doing, but you're always going to hit bumps in the road. There's going to be problems. And every time that happens, I don't think you can help but look internally and think, oh, am I smart enough to figure out this problem? You know, am I the right guy to solve this? Or, you know, what am I doing? What did I get myself into? What did I get my family into? Those are all natural fears, and they happen, and we've all got to deal with them and face them.
Did you lean on any speakers or mainstream, you know, public speakers or books or anything that helped drive that in you? Did you lean on any of that?
I've had really good business partners over the years, and people that I've been able to lean on. My current, right now, my co-founder at Woodchuck is Dre Nietzsche-Nelson. This is the third company that he and I have done together. And so it's really good to have a co-founder that you trust and believe in, that you can lean on. Investors can be a big source of stress, but if you get a really good investor that's, you know, will spend time with you and really be an advisor as well as an investor, if someone's willing to invest money in you, that's a pretty big vote of confidence. So if you have a really good investor that becomes an advisor and becomes part of your business, that can be a great support network as well. I think if you're building a small startup and you're starting to build a board of advisors or a board of directors, I think as you build those people, you want to fill those roles with people that will support you, people that believe in you and believe in your concept. But you know, it's they also need to be people that will push back on you and help you course correct when you're not quite online. You know, people that'll call you on your stuff and make sure that you're making smart decisions. So you want to find advisors that support you, but not blindly, that will support you and will guide you when you need guidance.
I think that accountability is important, right? Like the accountability partner or finding somebody that's like, hey, you need to sit down for a minute. Like, let's have a conversation and be really truthful with how things are moving, how things are going. This is what I'm seeing in you. That's just not productive. It's not helping the team. I think that accountability piece is astounding. And I'm assuming you've had different accountability partners throughout the years, right? Like it was never the same person until, like you said, you've had three businesses with the same business partner. It's probably your accountability partner as well, I'm assuming. He can talk open and honestly with you and vice versa. Can you tell us about that business partnership relationship and give some information on what somebody could do when looking for quality and traits?
Yeah. So Dre and I actually met when I was at Stanley Black & Decker, and I ran their innovation accelerator program. And Dre and I built a couple of products together there and built a really good working relationship. And we then brought that working relationship to other jobs. And we can call each other out when someone's making a mistake and say, hey, is that really the right decision? It's really nice when you have a group of advisors around you where you can identify a problem. You don't necessarily have to have the answer. You can say, look, guys, let's sit down and figure this out together. That's a really nice kind of luxury to have as a founder, because you don't always have that. A lot of times as the founder, you're somewhat alone, and you have these problems and you need to figure out some solutions to them. So it's really a nice luxury when you have a group of advisors where you can go in, admit that you don't have the solution, and you want to talk it through and build a solution together.
Are you, or were you, a first generation entrepreneur, or did you grow up with entrepreneur parents, grandparents, anything like that? Or were you just the first generation?
So my dad was an attorney, and he was an attorney his whole life. He had his own practice. So, I mean, it was his own business. He was a small businessman. He was an attorney. But I'd say the entrepreneur bug came really early for me. My brother and I actually built a little company together when we were just little kids. We didn't think of it as building a company, but we had a local golf course, and we would like to sneak into the golf course and go out to the swampy area just kind of to explore as an adventure. But we were out there exploring around in the swamp, and we found all these golf balls. So we started filling our pockets with golf balls. And, you know, as we were leaving the course, then we went to one of the tee boxes, and there were some golfers there, and we asked them if they wanted to buy our golf balls. So we pulled all these grimy golf balls out of our pockets and tried to sell them. And a couple of the guys bought some. And then we realized, you know what, if we bring these home and clean them up and bring them back, I bet we can get twice as much for them. So then we started regularly sneaking into the swamp and finding golf balls, and we'd bring them home and clean them. And then we started learning all sorts of neat little, you know, business tricks, right? We realized that the guy in red shirt that came the afternoon loved Titleist. And so if we had a whole pile of Titleist, he'd negotiate to get a really good price on it. So when we saw the guy with the red shirt coming, we'd hide all the Titleist except maybe three. And then he'd get there and say, hey, we only have three Titleists left. We saved them for you. So it's going to cost you $2 a piece. And we'd get top dollar for them. So we kind of, you know, we learned scarcity and we learned merchandising. And it was really fun. And in retrospect, my brother and I learned a lot of those early business lessons. So Hawken used golf balls to golfers on the golf course. It was great.
Well, I hope the guy in the red shirt isn't watching our podcast, because he might want his money back from all the way back then. But no, I think that's fantastic. But I think that speaks to what you were saying about loneliness, right? In the world of entrepreneurship, I'm a first generation business owner. So that loneliness and having somebody in your corner, your business partner, or somebody that you can bounce ideas off, that is understanding, I think that that's powerful. I think that that's definitely something that we have to continue to look for, because it's not like you can turn to your family and say, hey, guide me through EBITDA, right? Like, guide me through this and tell me about cash flow and investing the money you have sitting in the bank every day to pull it back just to gain $500 or $600, right? Like, and I think that that's important, and it goes to that whole loneliness piece that you were talking about a little while ago. And for viewers who feel trapped by the past, they feel trapped maybe by past failures, past bankruptcies, or stuff that they've tried to build a business. What is one belief that they need to release
to be successful? And like, what do they need to replace that with?
So when your business fails, there's typically not one reason why it failed, right? There's a whole bunch of different factors. And honestly, timing and luck are always a part of it. Every time you have a big business success, there's something fortunate about the timing or the luck that made that work. And the same thing is true when the business fails. There's bad timing, there's bad luck. So I'm of the belief that whatever caused that failure, whatever the flaw was, identify it, understand it, and try to turn that weakness into a strength. So like you're mentioning, you know, you also were not great at cash flow and you didn't understand EBITDA. So fine, lots of people don't understand that. That's a pretty common area of weakness. But my suggestion would be find a partner or an advisor that can educate you and that you can lean on it. And maybe you hire a fractional CFO or an accountant that can actually do that work and help you. But also use that to educate yourself. Like if you hire an accountant or hire a fractional CFO to do that work for you, don't just have them do the work, have them teach you what they're doing. So you both understand the detail of what they're doing. And if you need to replace them or at some point you need to step in and do that work, you understand it and you can do it. Because if you don't understand EBITDA and you don't understand your cash flow and your books and you're relying 100% on this person that you've hired to do it for you, well, what happens if you lose that person? What happens if they're sick at the end of the month when it's time to do the books? Then you've got a whole different problem, right? So identify what you don't know and educate yourself and try to turn that into a strength. Because I think every founder, at the end of the day, the founder is responsible for the cash flow. The founder is responsible to make sure that you don't run out of money. Right. So find people around you that know more than you do, but don't just rely on them. Have them teach you.
Thank you for that. I think it's important, right? I think it's identifying, you know, your weaknesses and learning to build on them. And they may never be full strengths, but at least you'd be educated in it. So I completely, completely agree with you. Coming up, we're going to talk about the turning point, the moment survival gives way to strength.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more unstoppable stories and strategies for turning obstacles into opportunities.
And we're back. I'm Nicole Anderson, and you're watching Underdog to Unstoppable on Now Media Television. Let's keep pushing past limits together.
Welcome back to Underdog to Unstoppable. Don't miss a second of this show or any of your Now Media TV favorites. Streaming live and on demand whenever and wherever you want. Grab the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and enjoy instant access to our lineup of bilingual programs in both English and Spanish. Prefer podcasts? Listen to Underdog to Unstoppable anytime on the Now Media TV website at nowmedia.tv. Covering business, breaking news, lifestyle, culture, and more, Now Media TV is available 24/7. So the stories you care about are always within reach. Welcome back to Underdog to Unstoppable. As we close today's conversation, we're stepping into the moment that defines transformation, when an underdog stops surviving and starts stepping fully into strength. Survival mode can become familiar, even comfortable, but growth requires risk, claiming space, leading boldly, and emerging a larger identity. The turning point comes when fear no longer dictates what's possible. Todd, we've had great conversations about building under pressure, building under risk and all kinds of things, but now we're coming from survival to success, right? And obviously everybody determines success differently. They see success differently. But when did you realize that you were not just surviving?
So we're, excitingly, we're kind of at that stage right now with Woodchuck. Woodchuck is really turning the corner and growing rapidly. We launched Woodchuck in October 2023. So we're just in the beginning of our third year. But we closed out 2025 really strong. We hit profitability in November and again in December and in January. And now looking into 2026, we have contracts for contracts right now for 10 times the total revenue we did in all of 2025. So we're really excited. We know we have something that's going to work. And that's fantastic. But just like you said in your intro, that brings new challenges and brings on more risk. In order for us to deliver on all of these new contracts that we have lined up, we need to raise more money, and we need to spend capital, and we need to be able to execute at scale. So it's really exciting, and we know we have a winning concept. We know we have a winning team, but victory is still a ways out there, and we have a lot of work to do, and we have risk to take, and we really need to be able to execute. Right? The expression execution is the chariot of genius. So a great idea in and of itself does not guarantee success. You need to be able to execute. So we're really excited at Woodchuck. We feel like we're in a great position, but we've got a lot of work to do to be able to capitalize on our potential success.
So first, congratulations. It's a good place to be right now.
It is. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit, before we get to a little bit more of the success versus surviving, tell us a little bit about Woodchuck. What does Woodchuck do?
So Woodchuck is really fun. What we do is we utilize AI technology, and we work with construction companies, and we divert wood out of the waste stream. So instead of sending all of that material to the landfill, we divert it, we turn it into feedstock, and use it to produce clean, renewable energy. So essentially, we take construction waste and turn it into clean energy, and we use AI to help us do that. So it's a pretty cool concept. If you look around globally, like two of our big problems, we have way too much waste. We need to reduce our waste. On the other side, everybody needs more energy. Energy demands are just exploding. So we're kind of taking both of those problems and pulling them together with a really elegant solution to reduce waste and produce more energy.
That's pretty phenomenal. Like the Poshmark or the clothing rewear apps, but for construction, right? And energy and renewable resources and things. That's pretty amazing. I can't wait to learn more and watch where this goes, especially if you're already so successful at it. And you said that, you know, new fears have come up, new risks come up with growth and success. What decision marked the true turning point from survival to growth?
So we brought on a really large client, a really big construction company, and they asked us to bid this massive new project of theirs. And we asked them if we could take on the entire project, which was probably a pretty ballsy ask, honestly, because we're this little teeny startup and it's this massive project. We said, look, let us take on the entire project. We can drive a lot of efficiencies and save you guys a lot of money. And at the same time, it'll be really good for Woodchuck. And we sold them on that concept, and they're like, okay, we're going to give you guys a shot. This whole project is yours. So we're launching this brand new massive project. So we're really excited about it. But yes, now we need to actually deliver on it. So we're excited and we're scared at the same time. But again, kind of like we talked about earlier, that fear can be a good thing, right? We're nervous about executing. So we're really paying attention and we're putting in the hours, and we're going to make sure that we deliver on this.
You know, I think about sometimes Richard Branson, when he says that even if you don't know how to do it, you figure it out, right? You don't tell anybody that you don't know how to do it or that you can't do it. You figure it out and you get it done. And obviously there's a lot of risk in that, right? Because if you're not a figure it out person, it's not going to go so well, and you don't want to ruin your reputation. But if you are a figure it out, we're going to make it happen. We're going to get it done. We're going to take the risk. We're going to make it so that this happens, because this is our success, right? Like, this puts us in another bracket. It changes our identity, right? And that's where you're at right now, right? Like, your identity is changing within your organization, and to the global market. And so, at what point in this identity change do you feel that you are ahead and not behind?
First of all, I love that quote from Branson. I love that, and I've embraced that, you know, forever. I think that's great. Tell the client yes, and then figure out how to deliver. Totally agree with that. I'd say for us, we had a couple of nice sized projects, and we were able to deliver on them and deliver positive unit economics. So we knew that, yes, we have a better concept. We have a better technology. We're driving efficiencies for everybody. So we knew that the concept worked. And we knew that it could be executed with positive unit economics. So we knew we had the better mousetrap. But we also know that as we scale, those unit economics will only improve. And so that's what really gave us the confidence to go after this really large project. And because we had done it on a smaller scale, we were able to prove that out. So we could go to this client and demonstrate the unit economics for them, right? We could play out the math and show them the math. Say, look, this works, and we can drive even larger savings for us if you'll give us the larger project. So having some smaller scale success gave us the evidence to prove that this works, which kind of opened the door for these larger projects. And I think that's a path that lots of small companies kind of follow, right? Get those initial projects, prove that the unit economics work, and then demonstrate out what this can mean for your client at scale.
I had a conversation with a couple entrepreneurs earlier this morning, actually, and we were talking about just that, you know, getting your reputation in place is probably the strongest thing that you can do as a startup and as an entrepreneur is letting people know that you do good work, and that you do good things, because then one, they refer you, right? They know people who know people, so they refer you. Number two, you have them to fall back on, right? Like you can say, hey, here's my reference. Here's my references. Have a conversation with my past clients or my past customers and let them tell you what I can do. So it actually helps propel your business by managing those few small clients really well and figuring it out, right? Is because it's going to bounce you to that next level. Being in entrepreneurship and being in survival most of the time, right? Until you get to that comfortability place, when do you feel, or what advice can you give to our viewers about that time in your life where you were in survival mode, but you needed to get to the next level? And when did you know like you were ready for that?
I think there's a couple different stages of survival mode. I think, early stage, right? You're just trying to get initial clients in the door. You're trying to get initial revenue in the door. You're starting trying to just get those bills paid, right? Everybody's familiar with that. But I think, you know, Woodchuck is at a stage now where, you know, we now have some big contracts and we have some big revenue coming through. But I still kind of feel like we're in survival mode because, now we have to deliver on these larger contracts and we have to execute. And if we don't execute, if we're not efficient at scale, it can still fail. So even though, yeah, now we're working with bigger numbers and we've got big revenue coming in and we've got big clients, that doesn't mean we've won yet, right? We're just playing with bigger numbers, but you need to execute every day. You need to watch your cash flow every day. In fact, I think a lot of startups, when they have some really big initial growth, they'll think, oh, we have all this revenue coming in, and they'll stop looking at their cash flow. And you can actually kind of grow yourself out of business. If you have a lot of operational costs and you're working on net terms, and the net terms that you are giving clients versus the net terms that your subs are giving you are different, you can get yourself in big trouble, right? So I think even when you have that initial success and money starts coming in the door, you need to continue to pay attention to that cash flow and make sure that the terms you're giving and the terms that you're getting all line up. And when it all comes to the end of the month, you've got enough money to pay all those bills.
Todd, this has been incredibly powerful. I really enjoyed hearing your story. I can't wait to follow the success of Woodchuck, especially now that you say you're getting out of survival mode. Not fully out, but you're getting there. I love to follow and hear more. And can you tell us again, like where we can follow your journey, and how we can get your book?
Yeah. So you can find Woodchuck at woodchuck.ai. We're online, look us up and check out the website. Hopefully you'll find something interesting there. My books are on Amazon. So you can look up Hyperscale is the newest book. It's Hyperscale, AI, Data Centers, and the Next Great Expansion of Global Energy Capacity. So that's the newest one. It's great. The three books before that are the Abundant Energy Trilogy. And you can find all of those on Amazon. And yeah, please grab a book and hopefully you like it and you can find something to take away from that. And then I'm also just Todd Thomas on LinkedIn. So hopefully easy to find.
Well, we truly appreciate you sharing your story with us today with such honesty and depth. We are reminded that being an underdog isn't a weakness. It's often the training ground for becoming unstoppable. If you're watching and still in the grind, still unseen, still surviving, know this. Strength often arrives before recognition. Keep building, keep believing. I'm Nicole Anderson, and this has been Underdog to Unstoppable. We'll see you next time.